if two humans can't agree on how to code a piece of language or a story, you can never get the machine to code it reliably, right? And there are plenty of situations where two people or three people can't agree on how would we code the story that someone shared. Well, at that point in time, if you don't have a human in charge steering the wheel here, you're actually not going to have a good outcome.
You're tuned in to the Data Masters podcast. In each episode, we dissect the complexities of data management and discuss the data strategies that fuel innovation, growth, and efficiency. We speak with industry leaders who share how their modern approaches to data management help their organizations succeed. Let's dive straight into today's episode with Anthony Dayton.
Welcome back to Data Masters, the podcast where we explore the cutting edge of data. Today, we're thrilled to have Russell Stevens with us. Russell is a strategist and entrepreneur at the forefront of using technology and data to foster more constructive communication and bridge societal divides. He's the head of strategy and development at the MIT Center for Constructive Communication and a co-founder of Cortico, a nonprofit building systems to elevate unheard community voices. Now, some of you may be thinking, constructive communication, societal divides, how does this connect to the world of data, analytics, and business intelligence? Well, I assure you, it's extraordinarily relevant. We often talk about structured data, the kind that neatly is organized into databases. But today, I wanted to venture into a territory we haven't explored that much on Data Masters, the realm of unstructured qualitative data. And this is precisely the kind of data that Russell is seeking out, rich insights from community conversations. And if you think about it, this is the kind of data that businesses should strive to understand, the nuanced feedback and unspoken needs that are often ignored or perhaps never even gathered. And you may turn to traditional methods like focus groups, and Russell will speak to this, I'm sure, because he's used similar. But, you know, focus groups are expensive, they're logistically challenging, and there are, in fact, biases in them as well. So today, we'll be diving deep into how Russell and his teams are pioneering new ways to gather, understand, and utilize this vital qualitative data to create a healthier public sphere, and how their approaches can offer powerful lessons for anyone looking to truly understand their customers, their stakeholders, or their communities. Russell, welcome to Data Masters.
I'm really happy to be here and talk about what we're doing and some of our common interests.
So I alluded to this a little bit in the introduction. You've seen quite an evolution at Cortico as you've worked through finding the right sources and types of data and data gathering techniques. You've initially started working with social media data, then you've pivoted towards lived experiences from small group conversations. Maybe share a little bit about your journey in terms of trying to find these new innovative sources of data.
It's a great question that really, Anthony, gets to the heart of why we do this work. So we started MIT as the Lab for Social Machines in 2014. We were essentially building hammers, looking for nails. And the hammers that we were building were machines that were using, at the time, we would consider them to be puny language models. Word DeVec, ultimately BERT, but basically machines that could ingest, organize, analyze media data. And you could think of that media data as digital media that was the byproduct of everyday life in this country. So Twitter and other social media data that we could get our hands on. We had more access to Twitter data than anyone other than Twitter and the Library of Congress, because Twitter helped get our group started at the Media Lab. So we had the full fire hose. We were ingesting news media, and we ended up ingesting talk radio. No one had ever done that before. So 24/7, 150 stations, because we could. And we thought that by ingesting and organizing and analyzing this, we could use it as a way of gauging public opinion, right? And insights about people what they were thinking and how they were living their lives in communities. And the nail we pointed it to at in 2015 is an obvious one, which is the 2016 election. So we basically built a machine called the Electo that was built to really try to understand what the conversation about that election was in the wild, out in the world, unprompted, right? So as opposed to public opinion surveys or focus groups, we were not offering prompts. We were just wanted to pick up organically what people were saying. And we were working with the Washington Post and CNN, the Wall Street Journal, to develop analytics that they included in their stories. We worked with the Commission on Presidential Debates to provide suggested questions to moderators during the debates, and really probably built the most sophisticated machine for analyzing that sort of data that was around in 2016. And even though it wasn't meant to be predicted, so we weren't doing this to sort of predict who was going to win or lose, we did have really what we consider to be near perfect information, again, using just media data that we were ingesting and structuring. And we missed the story like everybody else did in 2016, right? Like, we had great information, but we did not understand how dislocated and disconnected people were feeling from the system and the body politic and from each other, that many people just voted to, as they admitted, blow up the system. And in the aftermath of that election, we did a lot of soul searching and realized that, and this is, by the way, before Twitter got sort of toxic. At the time, Twitter was a reasonable approximation for public opinion. It was considered to be not so bad, not perfect, but not so bad. Even with decent Twitter information, great Twitter information, we realized that relatively few people were tweeting about what they thought about the election, right? And those who weren't typically going to be the loudest voices anyways, fewer people were calling into talk radio, even fewer were getting quoted in news articles. And that if we wanted to really understand what people were experiencing in communities and how that was affecting their perception of politics or of each other, there was really only one thing to do. And it was extremely counterintuitive for a lab based at the Media Lab building, basically language models. And that was, we had to go talk with people directly. And really, you could see the evolution of what we've done to the aftermath of that campaign, where we said, there's no replacement for actually asking people directly to share their experiences in their stories. So really, our story is since 2016 and into 2017, when we created Cortico, a nonprofit that's affiliated with our group at the Media Lab, that you could think of as the deployment arm for the Media Lab. We've built a conversation platform that allows us to talk to human beings at scale, right? And these are done through small group conversations that, if you were to look at, we can get into this later, if you look in a window at one of these conversations, it looks like a focus group. But the question that we ask ourselves is, could we hold small group human to human conversations at scale and use technology to make sense of them at scale? Because that's really the problem with focus groups historically, has been great information, but it gives you almost like too much unstructured data to be able to use and creating insights to make decisions, to give people an opportunity to express themselves systematically. So we have built essentially a conversation platform, spent 8 years building a conversation platform and testing it, that allows universities, schools, and increasingly organizations, even corporations, to bring this platform in to really understand what life is like in their own community.
And what I love about that evolution is you started, I think, where many listeners almost certainly would intuitively start, which is, and we have this bias embedded in us, which is big data, like more data is better. So, you know, if a sample of Twitter data is good, then all of Twitter must be better. And if a few talk radio stations are interesting, all of them would be even better. And if you had all of that, like almost by definition, this feeling that if we just collect more data, we will get better insights. And I don't want to put words, but would you agree with the sentiment that,
yeah,
it was like more data wasn't better, it was better data is better, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. Is that fair?
Absolutely. We thought our superpower was our ability to collect everything. I said, my partner is Deb Roy, he's a principal investigator at our group at MIT and the CEO of Cortico. And you know, we thought our superpower was the ability to sort of have the fire hose and to ingest 150 or more, if we wanted to, talk radio stations, right? And we knew how to do that. We had built a machine to be able to do that. But here's the problem. Yes, you could ingest all of that, but if only the same people are talking across all those forms, right? And they tend to be the loudest voices. And those loudest voices get heard on every platform, right? So Twitter, Reddit, Facebook, those are the people, and not the same people, but the same type of people who are calling into talk radio, who are getting quoted. And by the way, who are also going to town hall meetings and school committee meetings and getting themselves heard, overheard in some ways, all across this country. Then doesn't matter how much volume of data that you're picking up, if those are the people who are really using those platforms, then those platforms aren't going to tell you about how the average person or the underheard person is living life in those communities. So what we realized was we were picking up the loudest. We were almost creating our own echo chamber. We were picking up the voices that were being heard already. By ingesting everything, we were still biased towards the most extreme, the most loud voices.
And perversely, by increasing the volume of data, you're actually amplifying the bias that you had. So I think this is a great insight. And maybe share some of the other challenges associated with this type of qualitative data. I think, again, most listeners are pretty have an intuition about structured data. If I think about what orders have come into my business, I can think about a database table full of orders or all of the addresses of my customers, these sorts of things. These are the very normal or traditional structured sources of data. But here you're thinking about these unstructured, nuanced, personal kinds of data. We talked about one bias, which is volume may not actually equate to truth. But what are some of the other challenges associated with collecting, interpreting, and responsibly representing these narratives?
So the best way to think about our platform and their challenges associated with each stage of the platform, so I can walk through those. So it's a classic sort of input processing output. So hold conversations and their set of challenges in actually holding conversations among 4, 5, 6 humans synchronously. Processing is analyzing those, making sense of those conversations. And then the output side is sharing those conversations and those voices back into the community. So when you think about just holding conversations, you have to think about who's important, right, within the community who you're trying to understand. And when we say important, again, it's not just the loudest voices. It's thinking about the underheard voices in that community. Who doesn't have time to show up to a school committee meeting? Who isn't going to pick up the phone to answer a public opinion researcher's call? Who isn't going to tweet or make their voice heard otherwise? There's the prep work in that. But holding conversations for us originally when we created the platform, it had to be in person. So we stuck a recording device on a round table among 5 or 6 people and held the conversation and then uploaded it. Actually, the pandemic helped us in that regard. We moved everything to Zoom, and it's a lot easier to get 6 adults or 6 young adults on a Zoom at the same time and as opposed to in the same place. And Zoom does quite a good job of separating audio files and things like that. So it's quite good as an input device. And we've developed an app, a mobile app, as a sort of a FaceTime interface to make it even easier to collect conversations. Well, Mel, congratulations, Anthony. You've just had 50 to 75 conversations in the community you're interested in, your company and your municipality and your neighborhood. You now have 50 to 100 hours, maybe more, of audio and transcript to analyze. And anyone who's sort of looked at any of that kind of conversational data knows that is impossible for a single human being to make sense of. And once you start bringing multiple people into that, you have issues of intercoder reliability. They have to be coding the same kinds of things in the same way. So you spend a lot of time building intercoder reliability. Well, lo and behold, we get to the processing stage. We were developing, as I said, puny language models to deal with this data for a while. And then 3.5, ChatGPT 3.5 came along, and that kind of changed everything for us. So these models are quite good when they're tuned and they're in the hands of humans at helping humans make sense of lots and lots of conversations. And so I'd say the biggest breakthrough we've had is being able to take that unstructured data and turn it into data that decision makers and policymakers, but also people within communities can use to understand the other people within their community. So what we've done is we've built a set of AI sense-making tools that help analysts, sense makers, analyze these conversations and derive meaning. And we've been working on this for 3-4 years at this point in time and have a very good sense of what the AI is good at and what it isn't. We can go a little bit more into that later. And so that's the sense-making piece. And then the output piece is, how do we share these voices back into these communities? And it's a critical piece of it. Like, we do not want these voices and these stories to go just straight into a black box and up to decision makers, right? It's really critical for us that they get shared back into these communities. And we built a number of tools that allow people to hear each other's voices and people in power to hear, and for people to see that people in power and who are making decisions have heard them. So there's challenges at each sense of the way. I would tell you, though, one thing that is really important for us when it comes to understanding what the limitations are and what some of the challenges are, is that we do not push all of this into the AI and say, make sense of it. In fact, a big part of our process is both in the collection of the conversations. When we train facilitators, we don't facilitate the conversations ourselves. We get people from those communities to facilitate those conversations, right? So they know what's going on in the room. They can read between the lines. And we get people from the communities involved in the making of sense and the sense making of the conversations. We have built tools for people from those communities to use in helping understand what's going on, because we think they have the local context and they have the sense of nuance. And again, this is unstructured data that we're structuring. But if two humans can't agree on how to code a piece of language or a story, you can never get the machine to code it reliably, right? And there are plenty of situations where two people or three people can't agree on how would we code the story that someone shared. Well, at that point in time, if you don't have a human in charge steering the wheel here, you're actually not going to have a good outcome.
So I want to come back to this question of the human in the loop and how you engage humans working with the AI. But before we go there, you said something which I think might be intuitive to you, but maybe not to anyone else, which is, these are not people sitting alone in a Zoom call by themselves, reading off of a set of questions. But you said two really, I think, really maybe counterintuitive things that I want to push on. One is that there's a group of people discussing a topic. And the second is that there's a facilitator who's a member of the group that's not a paid facilitator from Cortico or from the government or whatever, something, but someone from the group. Talk me through that a little bit. That's, again, I think that's not what one would expect.
Sure. It's because the models that have been around for decades have said that only professionally trained facilitators can run a focus group or an ethnography in the way that the client needs it to be run. And we understand that. And there are certainly times that you will never get past the need if you're in a very tense situation where there are people on both sides. There's a few things about our model that distinguish it. One is, we, in the ideal state, the people in the room on the Zoom actually know each other or are familiar with each other or share a passion or an interest or an experience, right? So we don't cast to these groups classically like focus groups where you have the wax pro with his hat on backwards and the young Latina and the older black man. We actually want people who kind of know each other or are comfortable enough with each other to share, right? Because we know, we've seen that they'll be much more vulnerable, will be much more authentic when they're in a room with people who they feel like they're in their same kind of tribe. That includes a facilitator. And we've had this remarkable experience with this group down in Newark, New Jersey, Opportunity Youth Network, rather, that works with youth between 18 and 24 who neither work nor go to school. There's a terrible problem with absenteeism in the Newark school system that this group wants to advocate for. And so what we did is we trained their youth advisory board, young people, to then train high school students to facilitate these groups. So high school students had conversations, 4 to 6 person conversations with other high school students in their own school. And it created stories that never would have been told. It prompted stories that never would have been told had a grown-up been the facilitator or somebody from the outside world. The only way that you get that kind of story sharing is when you've created a space where people are comfortable sharing with each other. So that's one thing. Two is that we do is we really get people to share stories and experiences over opinions and facts. And we have some research that's coming out soon that shows that when you hear someone else's experience or story, you're much more likely to have empathy and trust and respect for that person as opposed to digging in versus their fact. So we encourage people to share long, meandering emotionally vulnerable stories in a way that focus groups don't encourage, because they want prompt response. They want to structure the data as much as possible. They want prompt response, another prompt. And what we want is the best possible articulation of someone's experience, right? So we orient everything towards telling stories because we're confident that the machine will help us make sense of it. We're confident that our AI tools will help us structure this. So the third piece is the human element of wanting not only people from these communities to be involved in the facilitation of the conversations, but in the sense making, the interpretation of the conversations. Because again, they're going to pick up, they're going to read between the lines in a way that even the best AIs are not going to be able to really understand at that micro level what's going on in that conversation.
Experience Tamer's proven data-centric AI, engineered to speed the discovery, enrichment, and maintenance of the golden records businesses need to accelerate growth. Tamer's expertise in quickly and accurately unifying large amounts of data across disparate sources gets results faster at a lower cost compared to traditional master data management or DIY solutions. Stop wasting time on bad data. Visit www.tamer.com, that's T-A-M-R.com, to see results now.
So it seems to me that the key idea there is trust, that you're creating a safe, vulnerable space where people trust each other. But, and then what that's eliciting is not opinions and ratings, which is again, the thing we traditionally think of. And I think I just want to underscore a point you made. That's not done because it's eliciting the best data. It's being done because it's the easiest to code.
That's exactly right.
Right. So the big idea here is get people in a safe space where they have a sense of trust, have them share the stories. But that then, of course, leaves the, which you alluded to, but now I'd love you to dig into, the obvious problem, which is, great, now we have a whole bunch of stories. And how do we turn that into coded in? How do we code it? And again, just to bring these two ideas together, you're using, obviously, AI, but you're not blind. It's not like you're opening a ChatGPT session and saying, could you summarize this? Very much the opposite. So maybe talk about the pairing of the AI capabilities with the human capabilities. What are you asking the AI to do? What are you asking the human to do? What can we learn from that?
Exactly right. And as I said, that was the breakthrough to the platform, right? Because before then, we were sort of decentralizing the sense making, but it was a very manual process. And there were very few sort of clients who were willing to pay up for that. So once the AI came into it, we knew that we had an ability to radically decrease the amount of time that we'd be asking anyone to be spending analyzing it. So I can walk you through the process. It starts with the humans, right? So we don't take the raw transcript or audio and put it into the AI and say, pull out the themes. We actually ask humans to do a couple of the first steps. One is to go through and make highlights. So the conversation, the entity, so to speak, becomes a highlight. And the highlight could be the entirety of one of my answers to you, or could be three or four segments, depending on what someone thought was interesting. So it's almost like when people highlight things in Medium, right? So we're pulling out highlights. And so a conversation gets sort of flipped into a bunch of highlights. And we actually ask the humans to do that who are involved in the process. We are working on AI that will give them a head start, right? And we prototyped that. But there's a human involved in saying, these are the most salient pieces of this conversation. And then we start the AI sense-making process by then saying, and here seem to be some key themes that come out of this, right? So we're seeding some themes and topics into the AI so that it can start to ruminate about and really start to understand as it scrapes through the rest of these conversations what's going on. So the first step is highlights some themes, but you have to then come up with a code book. Anyone who's sort of done this kind of, how do you turn unstructured data into structured data? You need some sort of a code book that creates a consistency across the analysis. So if you've got 50 conversations, you can be reasonably consistent that the tagging and the coding of those conversations stays the same all the way through, no matter who's doing it. That's, as I said, there's an intercoder reliability problem when you have multiple humans. But you don't have an intercoder reliability problem when you have the AI, but the AI needs to be accurate, right? So we go through this iterative process. And then, again, from what I know about Tamer, that's sort of how Tamer started, is this iterative human in the loop where the humans are kind of directing the machines towards disambiguating things and so forth. That's a little bit of what this process is like. Like, what's the code book look like? Here's how I would code things. And then you say to that, you could basically hit a toggle and ask the machine, how would you code this? And if you're satisfied that the machine is tagging things, coding things in the way that you want it, it's recognizing that this topic is actually about housing, affordable housing insecurity and food insecurity, right? And you think the machine is going to code it the way you'll turn that on, and then basically tell the machine, yes, now code the rest of the conversation or the rest of the conversations in that same way.
So would it be fair to say that rather than blindly turning this over to the machine to do the work, you're letting the human bootstrap it and then amplifying the human's work by turning, it's like the rote, boring part. Well, the interesting part is finding the insights. And then the boring part is finding the insights again. Like, you found it once, it's like, okay, great. Maybe it's twice or three times. And then finally the AI is like, yeah, get it. There's 72 other instances of the same insight. It's the 72 that is the interesting, not the first three.
Exactly. And then you also have this situation. So you get halfway through the corpus and you realize, oh, there's another theme, or there's another three topics, right? As a human, and which I'd had to do, you'd have to go back and recode everything. Again, if you've got the machine involved in that, then the sort of recoding becomes a lot easier. It kind of keeps up the lagging coding. So we've got AI-assisted highlight tagging, AI-assisted codebook creation. And then the third stage of the AI is we can actually help it to summarize. Okay, take a look at what you've coded. Now help me summarize what the key findings are. Again, there are plenty of tools and technologies out there that you can just push. You could push the transcript into the AI and say, cut straight to the end, to the theme. We just think like in the kinds of things that we get ourselves involved with, right? Which is making good policy decisions, making selections of local officials using community, that the community needs to be involved. Humans need to be involved in this process to make sure that it's being steered in the right direction. So we don't do anything. We don't do push button AI.
Yeah. And implicit in that statement, I think, again, I want to be careful. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it feels like you're not just making a statement of efficiency or efficacy, but you're making an ethical statement as well. You're saying whether it's possible or not, it's not right. So maybe, and admittedly, I am going a little off piste here. One would hope that ethics are an important consideration in business. There's reason to suggest that may not be the case, but in any case, it's certainly important to you, and it probably should be important to businesses. Talk a little bit about how you do think about your mission is about elevating underheard and underrepresented groups. There's an implicit value judgment in that, and that does involve ethical considerations. And I do think many businesses think about wanting to hear from their least profitable customers and how can I make them more profitable, or their least heard segments and these sorts of things. So there's a direct correlation here. But talk about the ethical considerations and how you think about the challenges associated with that.
Sir, yeah, there are several layers and ethical considerations, and some are quite tactical in a sense. So we've had a number of organizations over the last 8 years, specifically companies, come to us and say, we'd like to bring this platform inside. And the first thing you're confronted with is there are different stakes. Like if you do we did a project in Boston around the last mayoral election, lots of conversations in communities, and you can't get fired from being a citizen of Boston if you say something bad about Mayor Wu, right? Or candidate Wu. I mean, you can get yourself in trouble if you admit to a crime, but basically you're not putting your life or your profession in danger, but you could get yourself into some hot water at work if you say something in a conversation about management or about other employees. So there were a set of things that we needed to work through that had to do with voice identity. I know your voice right now. We've spoken several times. If I hear you out of context 3 days from now, I only hear your voice, I'm going to peg it to Anthony, right? So in smaller communities, people's voices are their identity. So we've created some voice morphing technology that allows you to retain your identity until you want to give up. That's an ethical principle, right? Which is I want to be in control of my voice. These are biometrics that we're sharing, that are being shared. And there's other things like redaction and what happens if somebody says something actionable in one of those rooms. So there's a set of protections that we want the participant to have. And that's a key piece of the ethics around this, is that we want the person who's sharing their story, they're sharing a piece of themselves with somebody who's going to listen and somebody hopefully who it matters to. How do we give that person as much control and protection as possible all the way through the process? There's that layer. It's almost like a tech or a methodological layer. Sort of at a macro level, our core principle is nothing about us without us, right? That we are working with communities, and corporations are communities, municipalities are communities, neighborhoods are communities, and schools and universities. And they've got to be partners with us in this process. If we go at this from a very sort of deterministic top-down way, we own the data, we'll decide what to do with it. There are just too many ways that this will go off the rails. So we start with really radical transparency. People know exactly how their stories are going to be used, who's going to hear them, what the intended outcomes are. And as you can imagine, so there's a consent framework that we start at the beginning of every conversation. I knew in this conversation, this is a podcast, my voice is going to be recorded and be public, right? For whoever wants to listen. That's not the case in a lot of our situations. We need to understand what the context is, get everyone's consent. So transparency. We also insist that the community, really people who are involved in the conversations, owns the insights, right? Now, it gets a little trickier in a company, and that's one of the things that we're working through. But when we do a project with a municipality, the city of Boston doesn't own all those voices and all those stories, that the community organizations that we've partnered with along the way have ownership and control of those. And the other piece is just designing for dignity, I would say, honestly. It's every tool we build has to pass that test. Does this make the person who shared their story feel heard and respected, or does it make them feel like a data point? And that really sort of fundamentally shapes how we design everything from our conversation guides to our analysis tools.
And again, going back to this theme of trust, I would think that part of what this creates is a sense that it's safe and comfortable to share their stories, which is what allows you to then gather the real insights that aren't being obscured by the normal biases that we get in the more traditional mechanisms of doing this. If you don't mind, I feel like you shared the example at the beginning of the 2016 election. That's obviously a very real world experience that almost every, certainly American, but even globally, people experienced. And you've changed your approach thereafter. Maybe walk through, in a very practical sense, an example of this inaction that a listener might think to themselves, all right, I get it. I can see how this works. And in reality, we've talked a lot at a sort of theoretical level. I'm curious to make it really tactical.
So we've worked extensively with the city of Durham in North Carolina. And the city was facing significant community tensions. Traditional public forums weren't working. What we found over the years is that the bad behavior that used to exist only in social media or when mediated through devices where you were anonymous is now seeping into city hall meetings. And frankly, you've had a whole bunch of CEOs tell us, we don't want to do open mic night and town hall meetings anymore because that toxicity is now even just seeping into in person. And that was a pretty big sea change over the last like 5 years where these behaviors are coming in. But they were having problems with traditional public forums. They were becoming shouting matches. And again, the usual loudest voices kept showing up. So what we did was facilitated conversations across different neighborhoods and demographics, focusing on their lived experiences rather than their policy positions, and included them in the sense-making process, just like I've described. They discovered that while people disagreed on solutions, they shared remarkably similar concerns about community safety, economic opportunity, and really just feeling heard by local government. So the city ended up using these insights to really completely redesign their community engagement approach. Instead of adversarial town halls, they started hosting smaller story-based conversations. Policy proposals began including specific language addressing the experiences that we surfaced and actually pulling these voices into those proposals. And really, most importantly, I'd say that the residents started seeing their neighbors as people with legitimate concerns rather than just political opponents, right? So the city manager told us this was the first time in years that they'd had productive dialogue across boundaries, across economic boundaries, political boundaries. And the best way to think about like the perfect deployment is there's a vertical use case. It's quite easy to identify. There's someone who needs to make a decision or make policy and they want to hear from the community. So what we offer is a better, faster, cheaper, but really more qualitatively robust way of pulling stories that really impact people's lives. And there's a channel for that. But there's also a lateral use case that people within a community can hear each other's voices and or the voices from other tribes, right? Even if those tribes aren't in conversation with you in the moment, what we can do is play clips from one conversation into another conversation across the boundary through amplification with media partners. People just start to hear stories from people who believe differently than they are politically, but who share similar experiences. And that's I would say the city of Durham is one, but we've had a number of other examples where you've had both this sort of lateral and vertical output and result.
I love that example because I think the intuition that as a city government, what one should do to understand one's constituents better is to hold a town hall feels very intuitive. And I think the same could be said for a business. Well, we need to understand our employees, we're going to have a town hall. Or we want to understand our customers better, so let's bring a few in. And in fact, I've even participated in these as a customer, and we'll do a town hall. But the thing you point out, which I think is counterintuitive, is that these experiences are necessarily adversarial. I'm being talked to, or I am talking to you, and there's naturally puts the opposite side of that conversation on the defensive. And again, just to put words in your mouth, your idea is if we create a safe space where people can share their stories, the insight that you gain is that actually, in the example that he provided with Durham, that the kinds of challenges that people have, despite their differences, are actually quite common. And then that bridges that conversation. Is that a fair way of saying it?
That is fair. And you sort of summarized our overall philosophy, which is hearing the humanity in others is necessary for democracy to function, for schools to function, universities, communities, and organizations, workplaces, right? You need to be able to hear the experience of others and the humanity in those experiences in order to be able to get past the boundaries that separate you, right? And if you think of like you really want to get to the heart of like the problem with social media and the silos it's created and the echo chambers and whatever phrase you want to use, it's made it too easy for us to dehumanize others. They're not in front of us, right? I don't see them. So I can call them names. I can think of them as other people. But when you hear that the other people actually have similar experiences to you in your day-to-day life, then you've created at least up to the potential for a bond or a little bit of understanding, right? Some people are just, you're just not going to be able to connect with. That's okay. But if we can, the idea that we bring into this work is that if we can surface voices and experiences that you wouldn't typically hear, that we have the ability to maybe empathize and create a better, stronger sense of humanity across.
Well, and then fundamentally get better signal out of the data. To your commentary about 2016, I think the insight there is that if you listen to the voices that are willing to speak on social media, or for that matter, willing to go to a town hall, willing to stand up, you're going to hear a view, but you may not hear a broad view. So if you don't mind, I mean, you, in a very literal sense, are on the cutting edge of this work, not the least of which, of course, being at MIT. But if you don't mind casting your eye forward into the future, and you make this point about GPT-3.5 and large language models being a transformative technical capability that's underpinned a lot of the work you're doing, maybe share where you think this is all going. And how are we going to, and maybe to put a bit of a sharp point on the question, there's a view that the future is all of us sitting behind screens, interacting entirely virtually, having friends and girlfriends and boyfriends, significant others that are AI, that our human-to-human interactions become less, not more. Admittedly, a dystopian casting of the future. talk me off a ledge.
Yeah, right. Well, let me actually talk you towards the ledge first, and then I'll try to talk you off of it, right? We've done some work years ago where, this is before GPT really surfaced. One of our students was interested in public opinion analysis and using a lot of network analysis and other techniques. He was able to basically use someone's media diet or get basically say, Anthony, where do you go for your news? What do you listen to? What are you watching? We get all of that. He would get all of that. And then predict accurately, as it turns out, what your responses would be to survey questions, right? So now you're in this world where you don't even need to do the survey. You can just take someone's media diet and then predict what their responses are. Okay, interesting. Not really scary, because what the hell? It's just public opinion, right? Now we're in a situation where you can create personas of people who may have an opinion, and you could simulate focus groups, right? And we actually had people who are working on that, not to replace what we do, but rather, for example, one of our students was exploring the idea of a small group conversation amongst a group of people who know each other, right? Because one of the issues with our model is that there's homogeneity within that group. We try to create heterogeneity across a collection of groups, but in our groups are people who are disagreeing with each other. So it's easy to get into a conversation where it is a bit of an echo chamber. It's safe, it's trusting, but it's an echo chamber. Say you got halfway through one of those conversations and you had an AI listening in, and it created a persona of what's the viewpoint that's missing from this conversation. And that AI participates in the second half or the last third of that conversation, bringing dissonant points of view into the conversation as prompts for these people to discuss. Totally cool. But then you start to say, well, do we need the people to begin with? If we can create these personas, right? Why do we have to go through all the expense of bringing these people together and having a conversation? And so that's the dystopian view, is that we get good enough at creating AI personas and using media diets or whatever the other prompts are to create what's Anthony's persona in a focus group. And do we really need Anthony, or do we just need his agent to participate in that, right? And we, as you can imagine, I strongly believe that's not the way to go, because we've done enough of these. We've had at Cortico over 250 deployments of this system out in the world to know that what you get back is unpredictable. The best conversations are the ones where people are sharing things that maybe they've never shared before, that you get stories that you wouldn't get because of the interactions of the human in the room, and they could be verbal or nonverbal interactions. The best, we track the health of a conversation. So we know this conversation, just two of us, is two nodes and we're going back and forth, and my node would be much bigger than yours because I'm doing a lot more of the talking. But if we had five people in the room, what does that kind of conversation flow look like? And we know that when people are actually in conversations where they're asking each other questions or getting each other to expand their story, that you get things that you're just not going to be able to get from a budget AI agent sitting around. You might get a nice distilled summary, but you're not going to hear the humanity in others in that case, right?
Almost by definition.
By definition, right? And if you go back to our philosophy that hearing the humanity of others is necessary for all these institutions to function, you can't remove the humanity, because otherwise it's just thematic summaries. And has anyone ever done anything because they read a really good thematic summary?
So yes, no, exactly. And I think what I appreciate about this is the level of nuance and detail that you're bringing to these qualitative information sources. And I think that's really the insight for Data Master listeners to take away from this, that focus groups and gathering and extracting unstructured data, qualitative data, isn't a matter of just sending out a survey, doing a town hall, a focus group, but is difficult and complicated work with nuance and strategy. But I've met many of the strategies you just described here, how to pair humans with AI, how to turn it into a conversation, how to create a safe space and a trusting space. I think these are all insights that listeners can take away and start thinking about applying to their work. So, Russell, I appreciate you making time and joining us on Data Masters.
Thank you, Anthony. I enjoyed it.
Thanks for joining us for the latest episode of the Data Masters podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on today's show. And if you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you never miss an episode.